Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and I've got with me today Deputy Editor Matt Matum.
Hello.
And our Contributing Editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Coming up this episode, we're talking to Edward Norton about making Bruce Willis work for peanuts. We're reviewing Motherless Brooklyn, Knives Out and Honey Boy, and we're discussing the contenders for Best Director and the supporting roles in the looming award season. So let's get investigative on Edward Norton's latest film.
Does anybody know what Frank was into on this?
There's something going down and it's big, and they were not happy about what he found.
We find who did this and we square accounts.
If I figure it out, I'm gonna make him regret it. I promise you that.
That's her. That's the girl that Frank was following.
I think she found something.
What happens to poor people in this city wasn't news yesterday, and it won't be tomorrow.
Where's everybody go?
Mostly just disappear.
This town is run by Moses Randolph.
When someone isn't seen for what they truly are, that's a very dangerous thing.
Do you have the first inkling how power works? Power is knowing that you can do whatever you want and not one person can stop you.
So that was Motherless Brooklyn, written, directed by and starring Edward Norton, and it's his first directorial foray since Keeping the Faith in 2000. So why did it take him so long to direct again? We'll get to that. But first, our Hollywood correspondent, Adam Tanswell, asked Norton what attracted him to this project.
It's sort of two main foundational things. One was just simply when I read the book, the character, the greedy actor, just goes, oh wow, that's like a seven-course meal for an actor. You know, just this character who has a condition that it's like jaw-dropping. It's funny, it's painful. He's smart, but he's a mess. There's so much in it that just the challenge of that alone was a powerful, you know, magnet on my actor brain. I think once the guy who wrote the novel and I had the impulse to take that detective character and the emotional relationship between him and the audience, but send him into an adventure that was more my own interest in certain things that happened in New York in the 50s, and kind of bigger themes than are in the book about American society, in a way. A lot of it had to do with my grandfather. He was an urban planner and a very progressive humanitarian who I worked for. And so, like, a lot of the values expressed in the film, especially by Willem Dafoe's character and Gugu's character, that's very much like my grandfather's voice. And I'd always wanted to find a way to dig into these complex issues, but in a weird way, I needed a character, I needed a vehicle that was inspiring and fun and a good story to take us into those more sophisticated subjects.
And why did it take him so long to direct again? Here's what he had to say.
You know, it sounds like a long time. Initially, I read the book and I got the rights, but then I went into making Fight Club, which was like a year and a half, right? And then I went and directed my first film. And so there was a period where I was so busy, I couldn't even begin on it. Then there's this long period where I worked on writing it, because I think, as you saw, it encompasses a lot, and figuring out how to tell a story that is actually an emotional story of a hero's journey, a person rising from being a real underdog to doing something and triumphing, if you want to say, but marrying that and weaving that with an ambitious big story, it took a lot of time to get that right. And that was okay, but when I was finished it, it took me 5 years to sort of assemble everything, and that probably was the period in which I felt the most mental frustration or just need to persevere and keep pushing. But at the same time, in that period, you know, I made Birdman, and I had some tremendously important creative experiences that were very fulfilling, so I'm incredibly lucky, because it's not like I was sitting doing nothing, and I always felt I'm going to pull this off eventually, and it'll be right when we do.
So, is Motherless Brooklyn right now he's got around to making it? What do we think, boys? Set up what this is about. What is the film about, and who does Edward play?
Well, it's set in the 50s, and Edward Norton plays Lionel Esrog, who's this kind of private detective. The story starts really when he's overseeing this sort of deal that's going on with these kind of gangster heavies that he's been asked to kind of keep an eye on. And I won't go into spoilers, but someone dies unexpectedly, and then that sends him off on this big kind of investigation, which he starts to uncover lots more going on in New York than kind of, you know, the initial thing he was looking into, really.
And this is 50s New York. And obviously it's important to mention he does have Tourette's. So he has this sort of affliction that makes him obsess on things. And it's that sort of obsession that carries him through this investigation and allows him to sort of uncover the truth of the dark underbelly.
And he also has a photographic memory as well. That's another aspect of the character, which is quite handy if you're a private detective.
Always handy if you don't have your iPhone with you in 50s New York.
And obviously it's also got an amazing support cast with Alec Baldwin, Willem Dafoe and Bruce Willis. So it's an incredibly impressive roll call he's kind of lined up. But do you think it works overall?
Well, it feels very, very handsomely put together. And yeah, the production values, the cast, the soundtrack, all great. But yeah, something just didn't quite work for me. And I think it's this character at the center. Like, as much as I admire Edward Norton as an actor, and as much as he obviously undoubtedly has immense capability, there's something I felt he was acting too hard in this. I felt like the kind of the character dealing with Tourette's, it's very hard to portray that on screen without it kind of seeming like an actor really going for an awards bid.
There's also a lot going on in this film. I mean, the original book from 2000, I think, was about, you know, private eyes who were modern day talking in sort of a 50s gumshoe fashion, which then Norton decided to make them actually 50s gumshoes. And with that, he also brings in sort of corporate greed, one percenters, the clearing of cultural areas of New York for big business. There's all sorts of things going on there. There's, you know, his own sort of psychological, as his character, psychological makeup from being an orphan in a children's home. There's so much going on that actually it feels like there's too much to keep track of. And it feels like I think I'd have enjoyed it more if he'd concentrated on one of those things.
It is very different to Keeping the Faith, of course, the first film he directed, which was now almost 20 years ago. I mean, that was a kind of religious comedy, as I remember. It's been quite a while since I've seen it. And this has a much wider scope, or much different kind of style and tone, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, even in terms of cinematography, Dick Pope did the cinematography and score, which is, you know, Daniel Pemberton and Tom York from Radiohead has done a track for the title, at the end titles. So it's like, it's just this on this huge scale that maybe it feels like it got away from him a little bit.
It does. For me, it kind of came together just about by the end, like when you got these kind of Trump resonances and things like that that start to come to the fore, especially in Alec Baldwin's character. I was like, yeah, this is pretty interesting, actually. But it was, I actually found kind of getting to that point was a bit of a slog and just a little bit dull, really.
Oh, dear. Let's listen to what Norton had to say about his performance and his portrayal of Tourette's in the film.
I can have conversations with myself all day. That part's fine. The thing I had the most anxiety about was what it would do to the relationship between me as an actor and other actors, because actors, filmmaking is just like this stuff. It's technical distraction all around you. And actors need each other. They use each other to create a bubble of concentration. And when you're breaking out of that to go do this other thing, you're the one disrupting the purity of that in some ways. And my solution was a cast of people who are theater trained, what I would call serious professionals, people who I knew were capable of working in that way with me without needing me to preserve too much of an artificial magic for them. When you look at this cast, you can see it's people. I relied on them to make it not a problem.
So that's Edward Norton talking about his performance on Tourette's. And he did actually go to great lengths to make this portrayal very believable and, you know, consulted the right people. But you found that distracting, Matt?
Yeah, he plays it admirably straight, but it just feels too many ticks, really. There's just, you know, you're just too aware of the performance. That was my main problem with it.
It's kind of reminiscent, I suppose, of Primal Fear, the first film he ever appeared in, where he was a character
stammering.
Who had quite a sort of significant number of afflictions as well. So it almost feels like he's going back to his very first role.
And of course, it is this sort of film where if somebody does perform a role like this, it's very sort of, it's naturally showy. It's sort of a little bit Oscar take note. So it does sort of call to mind, unfortunately, that sort of the scene in Tropic Thunder where...
We all know the scene you're referring to.
With the phrase one shouldn't say, but, you know, like that he's gone full onto that side. So it's very difficult, isn't it, to take it sort of seriously if you do have that in your mind when you're watching it.
Yeah, definitely. It kind of veers into that almost comedy territory at times. You can tell why he would have built this film around himself, because it is very tailored to his abilities, but yeah, just didn't entirely work for me.
I think on some level it's great to see him back, though, because he's hardly been on screen
for
the
last
few years.
He's a great actor, yeah. And also, you know, he's very competent at directing, and he's created this sort of old-fashioned film. It's an original script, and it's not a franchise. And in, you know, this world of Marvel films that Martin Scorsese has been so vocal about, it's nice to see something being made that is different and is prestige and classy and different. And he also made it for a fraction of those budgets. We wanted to ask Norton about that and how he made a period film so cheaply in a Marvel world.
Yeah, we're proud of that. I mean, I think that a lot of people say, why don't these movies get made anymore? People have been saying they don't make these kind of movies anymore. It's hard. There's, within our current sort of system, I think if this movie got made within a studio, even my friends at Warner Brothers, this would be a $60, $70 million film. I mean, you look at Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a great film with a great cast and a period and all these things. It's a $95 million budget on that film, you know, and we made ours for $26. And I think that that's a function in part of, number one, my cast being willing to work for scale, which is one of the greatest compliments I've ever gotten, that all these people came together and said, we care enough about this to get it done. And so everybody worked for no money. And also we figured out ways by planning, and some of what has happened with digital, you know, technology and effects technology is in fact, it's amazing what you can do now for price points that would have been unheard of. So we figured it out. It goes to show you, you can do these things. Like you can do it. You have to do it for love and not money. And a lot of very talented people have to be willing to commit to that and care about the work enough. Mm-hmm. But you can do it.
So a classy film with a classy cast. But is it worth paying good money for?
I mean, I think if it sounds like something that you'll enjoy, you probably will, if you know what I mean. If you're into that kind of really old school sort of gangster film and you're willing to kind of invest the time, then I think there's a lot of people that will get a lot out of it, I think. But you probably know from hearing us talk if it sounds like your kind of thing or not, or if it sounds like something that you'll probably just fall asleep in front of the telly watching one day.
Yeah, it feels like a sort of thing you'd watch at Christmas when it's on the TV and think that's a lovely, lush film.
Along with The Sound of Music.
Yeah. But on the other hand, if you do like a sort of detective, noirish mood piece with a good soundtrack and sort of jazz clubs and smoky sort of rooms and 50s cars, then it's a pretty classy affair.
It's the film for you, I
exactly.
think.
Exactly. Yeah. I think we're all sort of a bit lukewarm on this.
It's so competently put together that you won't watch it and regret spending that time with it, I don't think. But just, it may not be top of your list to catch when there's lots of other stuff out.
And it shows the ambition of Edward Norton. And so hopefully his next one, you know, he can capitalise on this and make something that might be a little less niche.
Well, I'd love to see him direct again, definitely. Yeah. As we were saying, he's such a talent. I'd like to see him act more as well.
Okay, well, bring it back, Edward. Let's see you do some more. Okay, it feels like we maybe had our knives out for that film. So let's move on to Knives Out itself.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to request that you all stay until the investigation is completed.
What? Can we ask why? Has something changed?
No.
No, it hasn't changed, or no, we can't ask.
I'm gonna live till I die.
You think one of his family, Walt,
killed? Is that what you're suggesting?
You all love twisting the knife into one another.
So that is Rian Johnson's Knives Out, a sort of glorious whodunit with Daniel Craig in the title role as a detective, trying to find out who's murdered the patriarch of this quirky family. What's going for it, Matt?
I absolutely love this film. It really, really has a lot to recommend in it. Firstly, it's just immaculately written by Rian Johnson, and he's very much leans into the Agatha Christie mold. He was reading a lot of that during his time on The Last Jedi, apparently, in his downtime, and he decided to do his own version. And it really just really works as a whodunit for me. It really, really kind of fits that mold, but is its own new thing at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a fantastic cast. You always expect a sort of all-star cast in the way that we used to get sort of Death on the Nile,
yes.
Murder on the Orient Express, back yeah. the ones back in the 70s.
Oh, look, and, it's Bette Davis.
And of course, Kenneth Branagh revived that with the Murder on the Orient Express, yeah. and he's doing Death on the Nile now. But this is slightly different, I feel, because it's contemporary set for a start. It's not the sort of dusty archetypes, the colonel or the vicar, you know, or the butler, who often would do it. They're characters that we'll recognise from now. There's the Christopher Plummer character, who's this sort of mystery writer, who's the one that they're investigating his death. He has a maid who's a kind of Latino maid, so they're dipping into kind of immigration issues. Yeah. They had one of the offspring is a sort of young boy who's kind of an internet troll slash kind of Trump supporter.
Yeah.
So these are all kind of figures that we can relate to in contemporary society. And it's funny as well. It's the funniest film Rian Johnson's done. And I feel like it's the most complete film he's done.
Probably part of those laughs are down to Daniel Craig and his sort of Kentucky Fried Chicken accent. I found that really distracting and I really couldn't get around it. Did you like it?
I read one review that said it's the one time that Johnson sort of lost control of the film was with Daniel Craig's performance. I'm not quite sure if that's true, because I quite enjoyed him, because he's sort of sitting there in the background kind of processing everything. I kind of liked seeing him do it. It's a bit like when he did Logan Lucky, the Steven Soderbergh film.
Yeah.
Sort of he does these little quirky roles in between the Bond movies at the moment, and he's kind of enjoyable. He's having a good time. I think we should have a good time with Daniel.
I'm very much team Craig here. I think, yeah, he's having so much fun, and we see him do so little outside of Bond these days that it was just great to see him actually doing something really fun. And I thought it really worked. Like, I felt perhaps how Jane felt when I watched the trailer, but then in the context of the whole film, it just really worked, that whole Foghorn Leghorn accent.
This film didn't work for me. I found him and everyone else really sort of heightened to annoying levels. I think, like, people are rewarding Craig for actually not being a sourpuss, purely because, you know, we were so used to seeing him in Bond that if he does anything different, we're like, oh, he's such a hoot. I didn't. I found him just very stagey and essentially annoying.
Did you not enjoy Captain America playing against his clean-cut image, Chris Evans, as the Ransom, he's called, the spoilt brat, black sheep
brat
of the family?
Yeah, and, you know, I enjoy a whodunit, like, as much as anyone else, but I felt like I could really see quite a few of the plot twists coming as well. So, yeah, I just didn't think it was as inventive, as witty, as fast as I should have done. And I felt like there was great pressure on me as an audience member to feel that way and to love it. And I just really didn't.
I think there's a great performance in there from Ana de Armas, who plays the maid that I mentioned, Marta. And she, of course, is coming up in the Bond film,
yep.
No Time to Die. So this is almost like a little dress rehearsal for their chemistry.
A little taster
of what they're going to be doing together.
Yeah, but hopefully not as many knives. Obviously, knives do figure in the film. It's not just a metaphorical mention of knives. There's a lot of knives. There's this old house. I enjoyed the house and the production values there.
The production design by David Crank is amazing, actually. The Game of Thrones style throne they have, Iron Throne, with all these kind of knives fanned out around the back of it, is an amazing sort of image that the camera keeps sort of moving towards. And that I loved, actually. I thought that was really kind
and
of
And the
beautiful.
House is sort of like a little dollhouse that the camera moves through, and there's different things to discover in different rooms. So, yeah, that I like that sort of piecing together and the way he'd done that.
I think it's the most complete film that Rian Johnson's done, definitely. I mean, I've always found some of his other films good ideas but didn't quite deliver, but this one I felt really delivered.
No, you can't beat Looper.
It's not the best time travel movie ever made.
It's very good.
Yeah, I love Looper and The Last Jedi, and yeah, just this film just pretty much completely worked for me, and I love the way it peeled back these different sort of layers, so you kind of see this night where the patriarch, played by Christopher Plummer, is murdered, and that happens really early on, so that's the kind of setup for the whole film. But then you kind of keep revisiting it and seeing how it actually played out, and you learn a little bit more each time, and that just I just found it so satisfying. Yeah.
I think it is satisfying. I'm not saying I didn't hate the experience, and I think anybody would enjoy it. I just think I didn't love it as much as I'm supposed to.
Were you a fan of the Branagh Murder on the Orient Express?
Not really.
Because for me, this did everything right that film got wrong, where that film was just so kind of stodgy.
And leaden.
Yeah. Where this film was funny, and it came together satisfyingly in a way that I didn't feel that Murder on the Orient Express did, I felt like.
I think I want the love child of those two films, so maybe Branagh's Death on the Nile will learn from Knives Out and be a bit more of a peppy version of the Agatha Christie.
Do you want to see Daniel Craig in one of those massive moustaches?
No.
I actually do really want to see Benoit Blanc, who is the Daniel Craig detective, in another mystery. I really would just love to see him go to another kind of family or another kind of closed off location and just, yeah, solve another mystery. Yeah,
he could have a whole franchise, couldn't he, based around him?
So maybe that's, you know, Daniel Craig's career plan for post-Bond. We'll wait and see. On to the next film, and this is Honey Boy.
I see you. Country real hard, be a 12-year-old. Pie fight.
Ugh. It's not a pie fight.
Think it through. What's your mother got a job for?
Just in case.
In case what?
I don't
In case
know.
You fail. In case it don't no. work out. Yes, man. She's filling your head full of fear. I pump you full of strength. Because we're on a team, and I know you got what it takes. You're a star, and I know it. That's why I'm here. I'm your cheerleader, honey boy.
So that's Honey Boy, starring Shia LaBeouf. What's it all about, James?
Well, it's written by Shia, it's starring Shia, and it's about Shia's life as a child actor. We have, the character is actually called Otis. He's played as a 12-year-old by Noah Jupe, who was recently in Le Mans 66.
He's so good, that kid.
Wonderful actor. And the story also flips to him as an older, sort of in his early 20s, played by Lucas Hedges. But most of it focuses on his time as a child actor, where he's living in a motel with his father, called James here, played by Shia. In reality, Shia's father was called Jeffrey, but they have a very similar relationship to what Shia really experienced when he was working on Even Stevens, this Disney Channel show when he was a youngster. This is way before he was in the Transformers films. And, I mean, there are sort of little Easter eggs in the film, like Otis wears a kind of orange Hawaiian shirt, which is similar to the shirt that Shia wore on that show. There's a cream pie sequence early on where he gets splatted. That happened in the show. So there's all these little nods to Shia's own sort of biography. But it's, and that in itself might sound a little self-indulgent, but it's really about his relationship with his father, who in reality was a heroin addict. He'd been in rehab. He'd come out and started to look after Shia as his guardian on these sets. And he, as we see in the film, he's an extremely...
He's a very poor choice
very
as a
poor
guardian.
Choice, a little irresponsible. He's kind of hitting on women when he's on the sets. I mean, he's the worst example you could have as an on-set guardian. And really, when the story flips into older Otis, we see what the effect has been on him. He drinks too much. He has this horrible car accident, which is something that Shia himself went through back in 2008.
He takes drugs and he doesn't trust anyone. And
it's worth pointing out as well in the film that these two timelines run in parallel. So we're kind of seeing what's happening to the older Otis at the same time as we're sort of learning about his childhood.
Yeah, it's sort of a butterfly effect backwards and forwards. It's like what the kid went through and how the repercussions can then impact his adult life. I saw it at Toronto Film Festival and it was one of my favourites of the festival. I just thought it was absolutely amazing. Did you like it?
I was a little bit lackluster about it. I think when I saw it, I was aware sometime before I saw it that Shia had written this film, and then I think when I went into it I'd forgotten that, and then as I was watching it sort of dawned on me, oh god, this is the story about his life, because I'd kind of forgotten a little bit of his biography. And as I watched it, his performance is amazing.
He's
Shia's
incredible.
Performance, as is Noah Jupe, as we were saying, he's incredible. Performance wise I thought it was fantastic. I think I found it slightly self-indulgent, but it's such a sort of fascinating, because he wrote it while he was in therapy. It's one of these amazing, when you know more about the backstory, I think I personally appreciated the film more. My first experience of it, I was kind of a bit fidgety while watching it. I mean, I was much more of a fan of the Peanut Butter Falcon, which Shia has just starred in, which he was filming while he was going through all this therapy, and then he had this arrest in 2017. Yeah. So the two kind of almost come in tandem in a way.
Yeah, you should watch them both together, perhaps.
Yeah, in a way, in a weird way.
I have to disagree about the self-indulgence, just because I think, because he looks in such close scrutiny at his own life and kind of really puts it all up on screen, I kind of thought, fair play to him for just being that kind of honest and...
Yeah, it's totally
that kind of raw
isn't
about
it?
Yeah, that to me kind of, there's nothing kind of vain about it to me. It's just, I mean, it must have been wildly cathartic for him. I can't imagine what that experience would be like, but... I think, yeah, because it feels so honest, I didn't feel it was self-indulgent. I thought it was, yeah, really sort of valuable. And yeah, you might go in with this curiosity about wanting to see the kind of, you know, the dirt, I suppose, from a movie star's life. But it's kind of so much more than that once it sort of really digs into it. And you really, really do kind of feel for him, and you kind of really can see how messed up a child star's life could be like that.
It's not salacious. It's not a muck-raking exercise.
No. And it's also actually really quite funny in places as well, even though it's sort of bleak. It is very sweet and loving and funny.
And even the dad character is played by Shia. He's, in some ways, you kind of hate him, and he's kind of like the worst dad you can have, especially one who's going to be working with you. But even he's not kind of totally irredeemable, and you can kind of see where he's coming from, and you still kind of root for him to turn his life around.
Do we think it's Shia's redemption, though, in the industry?
I think we've always known he was a good actor. You know, we've seen that in various films he's been in, not Transformers. But, you know, he has the goods, and if he could get through this, then, you know, he could turn it around. He could become the next Robert Downey Jr. who puts that sort of tortured past behind him to create this amazing career. Who knows? And on the evidence of this, he's going in the right direction. I think it's an incredibly brave film for him to have written and to then actually be in.
Be interesting to see what he would write if it was completely fictional, really, because obviously he's tearing this so much from his own life. Even though the names are changed, you know, we pretty much is, you know, in all but name, it seems like it's referring to his own story.
And we should mention director Al Morel as well, who came from a documentary background. She did a film called Bombay Beach. Shia apparently found that in a DVD store. He was researching a Bob Dylan project, and her film has Bob Dylan music in it, and some sort of employee had just shoved it in the Bob Dylan section, and then he picked it up and then contacted her on her website the next day and said, and that's, they did a music video together as well, a Sigur Rós video. Yeah. So, you know, they've got a clear relationship, you know.
And I think they would have had to have had a really strong relationship to make this film and for him to feel safe enough to make this film with anybody. And that shows too, because it feels like it's lensed with a lot of love and a lot of compassion for him as a character, but also as an actor. And it's so sort of evocative and woozy, and you get a real sense of the place that they live and the time they're living in. It's beautifully filmed.
There's also some really nice visual flourishes as well, which I think don't detract from the film. They don't kind of turn it into too much of a kind of arty, you know, kind of show-off exercise, but that just kind of deepen it in a way. And especially, like, there's one amazing scene, I thought, where the young Otis is kind of watching a scene that he's filming with this kind of, with his on-screen dad, and how different that is to his real life, and how he kind of lacks that kind of decent father figure in his own life. And it, on paper, it maybe sounds a bit pretentious, but yeah, it just kind of so works on screen.
Yeah. Honey Boy, you should definitely check this out. Do you agree?
I quite agree.
Oh, James.
We'll maybe go in arms.
Come in with us.
Knowledge.
Come on. All right, maybe, group hug. All right. Group hug. We're all going to say that this is a film. And probably out of the three.
There's a lot of dads in this issue, really.
Yeah. this is a dad thing, or a lack of a dad in Motherless Brooklyn. So I think probably Honey Boy is the one we'd suggest out of these three. Or are you Knives Out?
Well, I'd go Knives Out.
Okay.
Neck and neck, Knives Out and Honey Boy for me.
Okay, great. Let's move on to looking at the Oscars. Okay, so last podcast we talked about the front runners that we thought for Best Picture and Best Actor and Best Actress. Now let's look at the supporting actor and actress. I mean, we've just talked about Shia LaBeouf there. I think he's in with a chance for supporting actor.
I think so, although possibly whether his vote would be split between the Peanut Butter Falcon supporters and Honey Boy. But I think Hollywood loves a redemption story, and he certainly fits that mold right now.
And also we've got to talk about Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
He's got to be the favourite, hasn't he?
Yeah,
right
if
now.
He becomes supporting for that, or whether he goes for Ad Astra for actor.
I mean, I loved Ad Astra and I loved him in it. I think that might be too out there for some people's tastes. I think surely he's nailed on for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's so good in it. It's his time, really.
Yes, he deserves it. And what about, you know, talking about people who've been around for ages, what about Joe Pesci for The Irishman?
He's one of the main competitors, I think, for Brad this year, because having come out of retirement is always a nice narrative that the voters like. And then plus the fact that he is so good in The Irishman, and he's very different to how we've seen him before. He doesn't just kind of retread the Goodfellas routine. So I think he's a dark horse maybe in that race.
Do we not think Al Pacino though as well?
Well, but do you think they'll go head to head?
It's tricky because they're both definitely supporting artists in this.
And will they cancel each other out? And so
it's possible.
I'm also going to chuck in Tom Hanks for A Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood, because, you know, the Academy loves Hanks. They've rewarded him before, and he is delightful in that film.
Yeah, he really makes that film. And plus, the love in the US for Fred Rogers as well will surely help him.
I have to say, it's a bit of an outlier, but I'd love to see Ray Liotta at least nominated for his work in Marriage Story.
Yep, he's
it's
great.
A small role, Firecracker. But he's so good in that film.
Yep. And I'm for outliers, I'm going to say Jamie Foxx for Just Mercy. Very, very good. Very sort of prestige film. And also, what about, let's not forget, The Lighthouse, Willem Dafoe.
I'd love to see Willem. Well, he's had the Florida Project recently, didn't win for that. The Vincent van Gogh film by Julian Schnabel. He didn't win for that. He's due. He deserves it for that body of work. And he's fantastic in The Lighthouse. But I just think he's going to get beaten by Brad.
I just think, come on, The Lighthouse is just too bonkers for Academy voters.
Yeah, are they going to sit
through
that?
He should win for the beard alone.
For the beard and for shouting, "You are fond of me lobster."
Should win for shouting, yes. I think.
I should win it. Okay, so let's look at the ladies. What about supporting actress? I mean, there's been a lot of chat about Jennifer Lopez for Hustlers.
She is fantastic in it. There's no doubt about it. But for me, I have to say it's Laura Dern all the way for Marriage Story.
Cracking, amazing.
Again, I just love these lawyers.
You love a lawyer.
But I wonder as well, with Laura Dern, does she risk splitting the vote as well? Because she's also very good in Little Women, and that's also going to be a key awards film this year. And she's supporting in that. Is that going to take some...
I think you'd have to go... whoever's doing her campaign would have to say Marriage Story out is much better than... Not that it's much better, but it's far more the thing that showcases her dexterity as an actress.
Do you not think Little Women will effectively cannibalise itself, though, with so many effectively supporting female artists in it? I mean, obviously Meryl Streep for her, what would it be, I think her 22nd
and
nomination.
Anyone that isn't Saoirse Ronan is a supporting actress.
I think Florence Pugh is the best thing in that film.
Florence Pugh is amazing.
Especially after Midsommar. Which of course is not a supporting
and
performance.
She is formidable in Little Women. She is holds her own against the Jo March character that you should be rooting for. You actually do root for her character, which she hasn't sort of happened before. She's really great. What about Scarlett Johansson? Any hope with Jojo Rabbit?
No, I don't think so. Not for Jojo Rabbit, personally. I think, well, again, probably because she's more likely to be in the running in Best Actress, you'd think.
And then you've got Bombshell, which has obviously got two great supporting roles in that.
So that's Nicole and Margot Robbie.
Yeah. With Charlize Theron as Best Actress.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it as a three-hander, possibly, but I guess that those two, could they cancel each other out? Though?
They could do, but it is an important film, especially having come out of the Time's Up times and the Me Too movement. So, you know, the Academy may be feeling like they want to ensure that they shine a light on that.
There's a lot of buzz for it as well all round, so maybe we'll end up seeing it go for picture and director as well, perhaps.
Okay, quick one. Let's look at directors. Obviously, Quentin Tarantino should be in there for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Martin Scorsese for The Irishman.
And those are both kind of end of career epics as well, so I think they're kind of pretty much nailed on when it comes to
would
nominations.
Would Todd Phillips get a look in for Joker?
I would like to think so.
He should do. He's made the studio a billion or more.
I'd love to see him do that, actually. And, well, actually, Jay Roach as well for Bombshell would be interesting. But and then, again, a bit of an outlier, but Bong Joon-ho for Parasite.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great film. And Noah Baumbach for Marriage Story.
I think we're also sure to see Greta Gerwig in there for Little Women as well, because it's such a kind of great take on an established classic that... Yeah, she's definitely going to be back in there.
I hope so. I love her and I want all the very best things for her. So that's Oscars wrapped up until the nominations. That upsets all of our discussion. Let's sign off now with a listener question. This is from Phil Daniel and he asks, which director, actor or writer guarantees you buying cinema tickets?
Well, I'm going to go for the most obvious answer for me because I have to, but it would be Christopher Nolan that... Basically, whatever he does, I'll be buying a ticket for, and Tenet being a case in point, because I know literally nothing about this film that's coming up next year, as no one does, apart from the fact it's evolved from the world of international espionage, and plus a few people who are in it. But that's all I need to know to be there.
Yeah. Okay. James?
I think, well, actor-wise, it was always Robert De Niro, because I was 18 when Goodfellas came out, and that, along with Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, which I saw in a very close period of time, made such an impact on me. I always would come out for a De Niro film. I've had to keep the faith over the last few years.
Yes, but you've been rewarded.
I have been rewarded with Joker recently and, of course, The Irishman. Yeah. So, you know, as long as you keep the faith.
Yeah. I think I would go for director Luca Guadagnino. He's always does something a bit off-piste. I've loved all his films apart from Suspiria. So I'm keen to see what he does next. And obviously... I really hope he does Call Me By Your Name too. I would love it. If you have a question you'd like us to answer on the podcast, just tweet at us. Matt?
at Matt Matum.
At James Mottram.
And I'm TotalFilm_Jane. Let us know what you want to know and we'll try and answer. That's all we have time for, but don't forget, there is 10% off Total Film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF at checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. And you can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram as well. And it just remains to say thank you to Edward Norton and goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
And from Matt.
Bye.
And from me. So please come back next time. We're doing this all again.